The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Author, poet, and musician Ed Sanders is interviewed by Charles Ruas and Rick Harris about the lifestyle of the early 60s. Mr. Sanders then reads a selection entitled The Poetry Reading from his book Tales of Beatnik Glory.
The garden is open. The young girls began to go. The garden is open.
And the title of your book, Tales of Beatnik Glory, seems elegiac to me, as if you were nostalgic about a period of New York culture that's now past.
That's always one of the problems when you look into your own archives and try to focus in on the past. And I did everything I could in the creation of this book to avoid the jacuzzi scene relative to sentimentality and bathtubs of Irish potato tears over the past. On the other hand, I felt that the era, situated as it was between the Eisenhower and into the Kennedy era, and prior to the CIA LSD experiences, or right around the same time, I guess, but prior to the Vietnam War and the assassination pattern of the 60s and everything that went with it, that it represented a gem-like, lapidary-like era that was worthy of close scrutiny. So that's what I tried to do.
I was curious about your using the word beatnik. A poet calls himself a beat poet, beat coming from beatitude. Beatnik was the pejorative version, wasn't it, of beat?
If you read it in the Daily News, it was. But if you read it in Herb Cain's column in the San Francisco Chronicle, where it first appeared, it, I'm sure, was not intended specifically as a pejorative. However, Tales of Beat Glory did not scan, according to my interpretation of modern poetics, so the nick was necessary. But it's a that title was the end product of about 500 names. I made a list, and it won. It won the list contest.
And you wanted a distinction between the beat period and the period that was later called flower children or hippie or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Because I tried to speak specifically in these stories, which are set in a specific time period, that is around 1959 through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 62. I tried to set these specifically in the language and in the modes of culture of the time. So you will read clear through these stories and not find a reference to lysergic acid, to Timothy Leary, to anything to do with any power relative to flowers or anything like that. But you will find the conversational mode of black jazz players of the time, of the beat poets, of the filmmakers, of the people that hung out around Jonas Mekas and Ron Rice and Taylor Mead at the Charles Street Theater on Avenue B in 1962, you'll find that mode of culture and that language.
What was glorious about that period?
Well, glory is a human interpretation of something, and I so chose to interpret those from mountain points. Well, I just felt it was a wonderful period of years. That is 59 through 62. Your energies weren't sopped up listening to some agent provocateur rant at a Vietnam War protest meeting. You know, let's kill the pigs, man. You know. You weren't faced with all the problems that seemed to that I encountered personally. So I looking back through my reading through my mind and through my own personal archives, being a pack rat, I just felt there were significant things which happened that both spoke of the future, but were not in the future, but were overwhelmed later on and did not really. Survive. For instance, I don't think the Lower East Side of New York City really survived the onslaught of the East Village and the later things that happened to it. So that much of the book is set in the Lower East Side when it was still basically a Ukrainian-Polish neighborhood with lots of Puerto Ricans and blacks, to be sure, at that time, but had that wonderful and blessed human discovery known as rent control. And you could at that time bop into a real estate office and get something for $18 a month, you know. Yeah, you know, which now would be like at least $200, you know. It was the era of the underground film. I mean, there were people like Jonas Mekas and Ron Rice and Stan Brakhage and even myself. I made a bunch of movies. We were bopping around in pads and bistros and bars, talking film, talking the theory of film, and it was an amazingly innovative thing for that time, for people to actually deny the commercial way and actually to be able to make films that were beginning, middle, and end works of art, non-commercial. And it just seemed amazing, and there was a tremendous energy that one felt on the underground film scene, so much so that I remember working 6-7 months to save enough money to buy an old Bell and Howell battle camera so I could, you know, be like Ron Rice, you know, so, or Stan Brakhage, who showed me how to, you know, gave me instructions on how to develop my physical characteristics to be able to handle a camera like that. But anyway, who were the filmmakers? There was the music, there was jazz, a lot of jazz. Jazz was still extreme. Like a Sonny Rollins came out of one of his retirements and played the Jazz Gallery on St. Mark's. It was a critical event, y'all. If you couldn't afford a dollar to get inside the Jazz Gallery, you hung outside at midnight and listened with your friends. And there were the coffee shops and bistros, like the Samarkand on St. Mark's and the poetry coffee houses, the 10th Street Coffee House, and there was all kinds of little things that came and went, like the Total Assault Cantina that I described, which is fictional, but it was archetypal for a certain phenomenon of a flaring of a group of people and then dissolution. So it was flare-ups and dissolution of these little creative events of music and a lot of poets. The Lower East Side at that time had people like Frank O'Hara, who was living on East 9th. Charles Olson had, I guess in the late 40s, lived on 9th Street. Ted Berrigan lived in the Lower East Side. I lived in the Lower East Side.
Auden.
Auden lived on St. Mark's, I guess. Ginsberg had an apartment there all through the 60s. Still has an apartment
there.
But he had places. And Alexander Trocky had his famous loft. And there were various A-head artists like Jim Kolb and Bill Heine, and then there was the famous Herbert Hunke wandering around with his notebooks and his writings, and it was just a total sense of ferment. You never knew when you see Norman Mailer walking down the street on the way to Trokey's, or Burroughs was rumored to come into town. So it was like, specifically, the Lower East Side was a mecca. In the Lower West Side, Greenwich Village, you knew that the ghost of John Reed and Edmund St. Vincent Millay had lived there, and until he died, you could always watch E.E. Cummings walk across the street to now where Blimpies is now on 11th and 6th, but you might have seen E.E. Cummings. And so the village, when you could go to the White Horse and soak up Dylan Thomas vibes, and it was, so the West Side and the East Side were like these complements of in a very interesting way. It was a very complex subject, so there was just like a total universe, and the street people called the Lower East Side and the Lower West Side the set, you know, hey man, you know, I've been looking for you all over the set, which gave it a quality of everything being a jazz podium or a poetry reading. So everybody was part of this. And there were really no such, there weren't any, as they later came, there were no superstar distinctions. Everybody was creative. Everybody was a writer, poet, thinker, actor, lover, metaphysician, and maniac, all wrapped up. And so the streets were the set. So if you were living on a set, it was just permanent creativity. And that's what I liked about it. And that was the sense that later was destroyed, I think, by everybody leaves, but also the vicissitudes of the 60s. The poetry reading. Cuthbert's sister, Agatha, was tepidly torturing him over the phone for the fifth time that day. Why won't she leave me alone? Look, Agatha, I will never agree to selling the house. My decision is final. Cuthbert lived in a gloomy room at the Hotel Colburn on Washington Place, just off Washington Square, scattered with 40 or 50 dried orange peels. Those orange peels will attract copperheads, you know, his sister had warned him. Here in Greenwich Village? You never can tell. I bet there's at least one pet copperhead in your neighborhood with the kind of queer denizens it attracts. Cuthbert's hair was white and almost shiny. His eyelids were pink most of the time, as were his cheeks, which had almost sharply defined ovals of pinkness. His upper lip lifted up and out when he read poetry. He was 61, and he had been writing poetry slowly and quietly for 40 years. His room at the hotel was jammed floor to ceiling with memorabilia of the literary life of the village from the 20s on. Agatha, I have to click off. I'm going to a poetry reading in a few minutes at the Gaslight Cafe. Are you going to be reading? Yes, everyone will be about 45 years younger than I. You see, it's an open reading, so it should be quite an evening. Either terrifying or terribly exciting. And please, leave me alone for a few days, all right? Cuthbert stood naked in the center of his room, eating a cucumber, trying to remember what pile he had worn yesterday. The poet had devised a clothing system, whereby he had thrown everything away except for 7 complete sets of attire, and had placed a complete clothing bundle every few feet around the perimeter of his room. To select his clothes of the day, he merely spotted the pile he had worn the day before, moved his eyes one pile notch counterclockwise, and put on the bundle. In this way, he found that he only had to do his laundry every 49 days. The Gaslight was packed. Several newspaper cameramen were pushing people aside to get better shots. Someone whispered to the woman selling dollar admission tickets, "Is Ginsberg here?" Cuthbert had scant admiration for the Beats, but he certainly respected the attention, hostile, friendly, and otherwise, generated for modern poets and poetry by Ginsberg, Burroughs, Corso, Kerouac, and company. Student Beat fever was running high. Poetry readings were suddenly SRO. The New York Daily News, for instance, had featured last week's reading in their centerfold. The New York-based news magazines had published several articles on the Beats, which, however, salivated with cynicism and deprecation, such as the article titled "Zen Her," which had appeared in Time. Such garbage jobs by the middle-class mid-brow publications helped spew energy into the movement, for it was Cuthbert's belief that if you anger the cultural frontal lobes of Time Mag, you must be doing something right. And Cuthbert, who had missed out on the lost generation in Paris after World War I, was not about to miss out on another successful literary generation, especially one that seemed to be such an unstoppable and interesting phenomenon. So he decided to join in, to take a shower in the same energy as the Beats. What could he lose? The reading had been advertised as an open reading of, quote, Beat poets, unquote, But as it turned out, none of the stars of beatdom showed up. About 40 other poets did, however, 19 of whom signed up to read at the sacred table of the list mistress. One woman was irate at the 50-cent minimum. "We should at least get a free cup of coffee for our coming all the way down here to read," she protested. The manager had an answer already. "Well, there is some argument possible that you should pay us to let you read." The poets were requested to read only 3 poems each, or 5 minutes, though most managed to eat up at least 7 minutes before the nervous poets in the audience began to stare balefully and to twitch with displeasure. The owner of the cafe announced that there could be no applause because of neighborhood complaints about the noise. By an arrangement worked out with the police, the form of applause would be finger snaps. The woman leaned down close to a steno pad and jotted each reader's name upon the list, which was supposed to be maintained democratically, first to sign, first to read. The man in front of Cuthbert had an imperious voice. "Please place me at the head of the first set." Wearing a fur-trimmed cape, silver-headed walking stick, "for I intend to read a short verse play, Theseus and the Time Machine, and I seek an advantageous moment for its presentation, for it is a work of genius." Bowing his head, clicking the heels of his spit-shined riding boots. As for Cuthbert, he found himself scheduled for the second slot in the third set, meaning that his ears would long be assailed with verse blizzards. Not that he minded it at all, for he loved to listen to poets. But he didn't want to get burned for his slot either, so throughout the reading, he monitored the list table, alert for hanky-panky. Indeed, he occasionally would observe a human approach the table, bend down, maybe smile and whisper at the lister, and lo, she sometimes would scratch out a name here, write in another there. Cuthbert did not care about the others, as long as set 3, slot 2, remained Cuthbert Mayerson. Finger snaps. Finger snaps were somewhat inadequate to satisfy the approval-hungry needs of some poets. For a very few, when they had completed their poems and the audience was enthused, there was a flurry of snaps like someone crashing through twiggy undergrowth. But after a poet who was not well received, or not understood, that is, not humorous, there were a pitiful 4 or 5 snaps, then a dissolving silence. For the finger snaps to end even before a poet had made a move to return to its table, this was painful. And especially painful to Cuthbert, who thought along this line. If the previous reader was given a mere 5 finger snaps, what am I to receive, 3? Cuthbert noted that there were several poets present who wrote frantically when anyone was on the podium reciting, stopping only when there was no urging voice, as if the flowing words unleashed their own goat pen of babble. Other poets came fortified with an honor guard of close friends who sat at the same table protectively, and when the poet rose to utter its verse, the entire table would turn their chairs to face the poet directly, would smile appreciatively and laugh heartily, and at the end would snap their fingers calisthenically and with great duration. Set 1, Reader A, The Screamer. This jarred the reading to a start. Carl Rothstein, just released from the madhouse, pointing to his shock burns, with a flat, long face and wire-rimmed spectacles, his hair pulled up and back for that Aldous Huxley look, beginning with a deep voice. A feigned deepness, it would seem, because of the poet's extreme youth. "I have just been disgorged from the elementary ward of Shreveport Psychiatric." At once he ripped open his shirt, the buttons popping upon the floor, and pointed to his T-shirt, upon which was crudely painted, "I was Buddha." Then he read, "My mother offered me a bobsled, saying, 'There is the hill. "What hill?" I replied. "You mean that mountain over there with cliffs and gorges?" "Go on down the hill, my son," said she, and gave me a quick, may I say rude, shove of her boot. This was immediately followed by a piercing scream. Apparently to indicate the nature of the down mountain bobsled ride, which lasted with pauses for breath at least 5 minutes. Man, could he scream. After his voice gave out, the audience was almost silent as Rothstein walked back to his table, about 4 finger snaps punctuating the displeasure. There was a jazz finger snapper in the audience, in a beret and sunglasses, and a black silk scarf knotted on his neck above his Oberlin sweatshirt. He had begun to snap vigorously in abstract patterns about halfway through the scream, nodding and weaving, eyes closed, shaking his wrists like a maracas player, whispering, "Dig it," and "Groovy, solid, existence, Dhammapada, man." After the scream, jazz finger snapper pulled out a bottle of wine. There was a man and woman and 2 children, apparently a family of tourists, who sat next to the snapper. He took a swig and passed the wine to the boy of the family, who hesitated, looked at his father, shrugged, took a swig, offered it to his mother and father, who said not a word, then handed it back to the snapper. The boy's mother looked like a case of hydrophobia. As her eye whites flared and mouth fell open, she shook her fist at her son. "I'll see you about this later." Set 1, Reader B. This particular reader looked unlikely to offend, dressed as he was in a business suit with a blue polka dot bow tie knotted crookedly. The poet began, nervously holding a trembling fist of crinkled white pages. "This is entitled Nocturne number 467. Followed by a long pause, then a deep, hissing sucking of air. "Cloistered in the convents of our minds, we pull down our pants and show our behinds." A titter tattered the silence. The woman from Des Moines grabbed her husband, son, and her daughter and pulled them away. "Come on, this is filth." "While lemon aardvarks from Jersey City invade the white undergarments of fate." Another titter. And the poet continued. The father knocked over his metal-backed ice cream parlor chair. The sight of the family splitting upset the reader so much that he began to stammer. He regained his composure by lighting a cigarette in the middle of his poem with a metallic click-clack of his Zippo lighter, followed by a fierce intonation of a doublet of religious sonnets, after which he sat down. Set 1, Reader C. This reader was popular with the throng, for he was the first obvious real-life beat poet. Poverty was written upon his face, as was Zen fanaticism and the ravages of compulsive hitchhiking. He insisted on standing on a chair to read. In doing so, he bumped his head on the low metal ceiling, but remained there nevertheless, his head having to lie on its right side to fit beneath the ceiling. His sandals were homemade, of rope and soles cut from leather luggage. He was funny. At least the packed coffee house thought so. At this point, early in the reading, people were standing in line 50 feet up MacDougall Street, waiting to get in. The police were on the scene, and the manager of the Gaslight made an announcement that people could not block the exits or the aisles, and that the police had threatened to call in the fire department. Spectators were forced to squat along the side wall or to sit on the stairway leading up to the toilets, for each table was hopelessly packed. The manager sneaked all the 5s and 10s out of the cash register into the safety of the thick wad in his pocket, thinking, "Money! I'm making money!" urging his waitress on with an occasional goad. "Sell more! Lean over the table, unbutton the blouse button maybe, touch the customer, anything, sell." Set 1, Reader D, The Shy Mumbler. This man read in a near whisper, so that gradually the audience grew quiet. It became almost like a game as they leaned across their tables, positioning their ears for maximum data. But it was impossible to hear. The reader was sitting on a stool and had almost turned away from the readers. "Louder!" someone rudely yelled, which brought about a temporary rise, then a long fade. The poems were like papyrus fragments. Dot, 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 love, dot, 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 ratchet wrenched, dot, 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 goodbye, dot, 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 ungent. This was good for those who wrote their own poetry while listening to the readers. For the whisperer's lines were phantom inspirations, and his words, half heard, were permutated wonderfully in their minds. Was it in spite of the late moon? Or was it spade of the lagoon? Or supplicated tortillas of the bent spoon? Set 1, Reader E, The Angry Witch. This poet possessed a cutting voice with overtones of shrill. By the end of her first poem, her voice had risen maybe half an octave, glasses sliding down her nose because of the way she trembled. "This poem is dedicated to my husband, Roger, who is a skull by now. Sick bard in the lonely cave." The poem opened with notification that a kettle of taper eyes was slowly simmering, and that, quote, "even the sibyl," unquote, was banned from the cave of the bard. The next quatrain asserted the existence of a catacombs beneath Washington Square Park, where the, quote, "covening minstrels," unquote, of Washington Square North were wont to meet. To appease the hungry ghost of her husband Roger, she had buried his hopefully symbolic teeth in the cave of the bard, the entrance to which was a hidden door at the base of Washington Arch, guarded by a silver baboon and 6 owls. Well, this particular poem was causing the jazz fingersnapper to beat upon his table with a coffee spoon. He was so excited. The poem mentioned the Gnostic Pleroma, where, quote, "broomsticks are toothpicks. Sick ghosts muttering, neck, neck, were to sprout from the teeth." Cuthbert shuddered at this line and wound his scarf around his neck, reminding himself of his long distaste and distrust regarding the possibility of the reality of vampires, a fact which had caused him to wake up many a morning with a crick of the neck due to having wrapped his head in a protective towel during the night. Cuthbert was quite relieved when the next 2 poems were translations from Ovid. "Thank God for Ovid," he muttered to himself. Set 1, Reader F. An experimental versifier who had flown in from Toronto, he happily announced, just for this august reading. His first poem was entitled 69 Drips. To effect the poem, he brandished a maroon gym sock filled with pea soup, into which had been affixed a cocktail straw so that the soup dripped slowly from the sock through the straw into a teacup. As each drip dripped, the reader shouted, "Drip 1, then drip 2, and so on, until 69 had been reached. His next and last poem he called 2 × 2 infinity, and slowly began to stagger forward. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, varying the time links between numbers. He made it to 2,097,152 before the MC hooked him off the stage. This concluded the first set. Intermission involved a rapid delivery cell of lukewarm coffee crowned with questionable whipped cream, tea, and cider with cinnamon sticks, and for Cuthbert Mayerson, the rising of the fear. The second set seemed interminable. Everyone seemed bent on translating into elegiac couplets their versions of the Babylonian creation epic. Cuthbert, nervous, ceased to pay much attention to the tonal blasts. Rather, he concentrated on the all-important final selecting and sequencing of what he was to read. Cuthbert looked intently at what he proposed to read. All at once, right in front of his eyes, he saw at least four lines that had to be changed immediately. Neatly, neatly, he told himself, for he did not want to be unable to read his own stuff. Next, he shuffled the order of the poems to achieve that perfect rhapsody. But angst afflicted him. I have not read for years, for years. Am I sweating? Are my eyes red? Why is that person reading forever? Maybe I should recite instead some Shelley from memory. I wore the wrong clothes. Certain readers interrupted his fear. A man who ran a candy store in the Bronx intoned his Image Trouvée manifesto. Based on certain poetic principles learned while stocking his candy jars, prior to noontime klepto invasion of school children. And there was a school teacher who began a poem, Carpathian horsemen joust inside the rotating triangle. Well, Cuthbert thought that was the funniest he had heard, and giggled so, and was sneeringly stared at by the teacher's table of henchmen. There was another poet who read at least a 300-line poem called The Philosophy of Thales the Milesian. Though Cuthbert knew and snickered accordingly, that Thales had left not one extant line of work from which to draw such a fierce and lengthy poem. There were a couple of diverting sex maniacs, one in particular who read a series of haiku relative to experiments with mayonnaise and the Bayonne, New Jersey telephone book for 1959. It did little to allay the fear of Cuthbert Marison, who, at that moment, would have bet the family mansion that he was to be booed from the reader's chair. During the second intermission, Cuthbert walked over again to check the reading list. Had one or two, perchance, moved up above him? He scowled appropriately at the list keeper, who assured him, oh, no, nothing could ever alter the ordained array for set three. Yet, even as she was protesting her innocence, a wan poet with a W.B. Yeats Bill Haley haircut strode up, checked the list, and uttered an angry wail. Hey, you move my name down the list. The keeper was really caught this time. Oh, well, I looked for you, and I didn't see you. I thought maybe you'd split. Sorry. A pitiful excuse, the man replied, stalking back to his chair. As the assembly was hushed for the beginning of the set, Cuthbert suddenly became aware of a painful fact. Whereas the Gaslight had been packed for set one, the several hours intervening had seen the place become half empty, and more were oozing toward the door each minute. To make things worse, the first reader had left his table to approach the podium, carrying an armload of work that had to consist of at least 1,000 pages. I'll never get to read, Cuthbert exclaimed. The man commenced. The work I shall read tonight is a section from my lifelong endeavor, Voyage of the Sun God to Brooklyn. It is a rather lengthy, so I shall read only the final and culminating 600 lines. The sentences in Gaelic will be numerous and represent the 78 commandments from the Sun God to the people of Brooklyn. I shall translate the 78 commandments at the end of the poem. Well, the introduction alone caused about 10 patrons to lunge for the exits. A shudder passed among the remaining poets, stomachs churning, fearful, eager, taut fingers on black spring binders. The man read like a tent revivalist, raising his fist, moaning. Even his frantic performance could not stanch the flow of fleeing feet. Cuthbert was caught, helpless, wanting really to leave, yet tied to his chair with desire to read. At last it was set three, slot two. Cuthbert Mayerson read slowly, his coin-shaped pinknesses of cheek aflame, his upper lip jutting out pointedly. Sonorous was his voice, chanting his short, subdued, and symbolic poems of Pi-Do-Pi-Jo-Philia. The audience was very appreciative of his work and afforded him the only actual hand-clapping of the night. A temporary violation of rules that sent the manager rushing to the front door to see if any police were outside. At last it was over. A woman approached Cuthbert. "Say, I liked your poem." "You did? Which one do you mean?" Cuthbert was all smiles. The woman paused, a cheek muscle twitching. The one about America. "Oh, you mean the last one I read, The Barefoot Moth? I guess that was the one. It was the one that received the applause." Cuthbert walked happily up MacDougall Street toward his hotel, where, depositing his poetry, he decided to reward himself for bravery. So he proceeded to Sheridan Square, grabbing the IRT uptown to 42nd Street, and a refreshing saunter.
Sometimes it took a man of steel to set the world right, but not this time, Mr. Mac. I saw the poets holding guns. I saw
Charles Ruas and Rick Harris continue the interview with Ed Sanders, discussing the changes in his creative interests.
You yourself underwent so many transformations in the 60s.
Absolutely.
Going from writing poetry and reading poetry to forming your own rock band, The Fugs.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of like on a bed, I guess. Thule and I organized The Fugs. He thought of the name, Thule Kupferberg, in the late... Early 65, but yeah, that's true. But you see, they formed the Fugs, and the Fugs were brought forward on a whole different plateau of concerns than Tales of Beatnik Glory or that Beat era. But that sort of was when we formed it. I mean, the Vietnam War was heating up, so that became an immediate issue with the Fugs. So if I'd have formed the Fugs in 62. I don't know, we probably would have, our main social concern might have well been like, say, the legalization of pot or one would not know, you know. Or maybe we would have certainly had a four-letter word problem, but... So it was the wings that the Fugs tried to sail aloft upon were certain social concerns that were arising. And, you know, somebody bet me $50 that we could never have a rock group or any kind of music group that ever recorded. So I took that person up on that bed and proceeded to help organize it. And that's the way it happened.
But the bet took you over, didn't it? Eventually.
Yeah, it's one of those things like, picking the wrong college or something. No, it was the right college, but it was a four-year... Well, even the terminology for it hadn't been developed at that point in time. That for the word trip, you know, it was a trip with a certain ticket to it that we weren't aware of. And how we wound up, you know, 4 years staying in every Holiday Inn in America, you know what I mean? got a little hairy. But it was interesting. We started out, as you say, that we started out as poets because our first songs we ever sat in we rehearsed in my bookstore. And our first songs were like three William Blake songs, All Sunflower Weary of Time, and I guess we had...
Oh, Rose Thou Art.
Well, Oh, Rose Thou Art Sick, I was a little afraid to try to record the Fugs. I did not at that point in time. But I did do Oh, Rose Thou Art Sick. But we had How Sweet I Roam from Field to Field, and another one, Long John Brown and Pretty Mary Bell. We did that one. And then we did Swinburne from Atalanta and Caledon, before the beginning of years, chorus. And we did, you know, various... Thule did Dover Beach, Matthew Arnold. We did a lot of poems. But, I mean, it quickly degenerated in many ways because of... None of us were trained in the field of terpsichore and calliope and melodia. But we had fun anyway for 4 years, let's put it that way. I had this bookstore called the Peace Eye Bookstore, which was located on 10th between B and C. Is now a burnout building. It's one of those buildings, I guess they light the fire and then head for the call insurance company, you know. But anyway, I wouldn't know. But it's right near where Ginsberg just got mugged. That was that poem we printed in the New York Times. He got mugged next door to that. Anyway, we were formed there, Thule and I. Thule lived upstairs. And I said, hey, you want to form a rock band? He said, you know, why not? You know. And, of course, we couldn't think of a title. So like picking a title for Tales of Beatnik Glory, we made a list, you know. And then we came to Mailer's Little Fugs. And it was much better than the word, which it sounds like, in terms of, at that point, you approach the Village Voice with an ad that depicted a music group with the name of a gutter expletive, you wouldn't get the ad in. So we picked Fugs and went with it. Diane DePrima, the, you know, had her theater then with Alan Marlowe, American Theater for Poets on 4th Street, and she heard about it and allowed us to play Monday nights. And so we didn't know what to do. We had to write some songs and everything. Thule wrote songs, I wrote songs, other people wrote songs. And then Harry Smith, the inimitable and brilliant filmmaker and folklorist and specialist in Indian languages, was a friend of mine, and we he knew Moash at Folkways, so we somehow arranged a recording studio that Moash would pay for. And we called the, what were we called? How did we get Moash? We had a call, we said sort of modulate the word Fug. Then we called it the Fugs Jug Band. That's how we went to Ash, I guess, and he put up the money. So we went up there, and Harry Smith produced the session. So I think his production of it involved smashing a bottle of rum against the wall to sort of get it going well. So we recorded all our songs that date, which must have been about 40 songs in one big spewing of lyrics. And that, I mean, that guy at ESP has been putting out about, I don't know, he keeps putting out albums from that original session and the one after that. So I don't know, I guess he's about ready to run out of, I don't know, he keeps putting them out, sort of bootlegging them. But anyway, that was the original take on the Fugs. We got together a bunch of poets, wrote a bunch of songs, Moash sent us right into a recording studio, and in one three-hour session, four albums, or three albums.
And what became of you as a musician?
Well, I never was much of a musician. The invention of the tape recorder was good for me, because I could sit around. I bought an organ, we had an organ, I guess, an auto harp. And, let's see, I used to wrote a lot of songs, wrote about 200 songs, most of which never were recorded. But I did write about a couple hundred songs during that four-year period. And what happened is that my poetry suffered. I went through a period of years where I didn't even write poetry, two or three there, which was unfortunate. But I'd had a lot of poetry before, and since then, of course, since the Fugs broke up, I've written 200 or 300 pages of poetry. So, but I did kind of neglect, because you have to become like a head robot or something to run or help to organize a rock band with all of the minutiae and the thousands of particulars every day involved in seeing everybody gets on a plane and, you know, I mean, seeing nobody throws any. See, the Fugs weren't a big band, you see, in terms of money. We made a little bit of money, enough to get around the country, but if we'd have pulled a 10 Years After scene or a Mick Jagger scene and thrown a couple of TV sets out the window of a motel in Dubuque, Iowa, that would have been it for the Fugs. Man, we'd be in jail in Iowa and still paying for our TV sets. So, I mean, it was very marginal. We couldn't. We wanted to be freaky, but we you know, many times you pick up a TV and say, God, I wish I could afford to throw it down into the abyss there. But, I mean, that's only for, you know, making light of a situation. But when we had wasn't quite as successful fiscally as been alleged, I must say. But we kept going for 4 years, put out 7 or 8 albums, and that was it.
And when you returned to writing, that's when you began doing prose rather than poetry?
Doing both. Picking up on the poetry again and bopping into prose in a way that I'd never done. I'd never, you know, I always poo-pooed prose. I was one of these people that make a mistake when they're teenagers, think, oh, I won't read any of these novels. I'll read the poetry and hell with the novels, you know. And then so you wake up and 10 years later try to write a novel, you know, you never really learned how. So beatnik snobism helped retarded my prose career, but I think I've rectified it a little bit, so it's getting there. Drop a successful rock band, and then your money supply rapidly retards, I must say, so. But I had a bookstore to keep me going, Peace Side Bookstore, which lurched along in semi-fiscal disaster, but survived during this period of these years, more or less, 65 through, I guess I closed it in 70 to write the Manson book. But the idea, I decided to get into prose, and the Esquire was going to send me out to, right after the Manson case broke, they were going to, in December of 69, Esquire was going to send me out to Spahn Ranch to check it out and write a quick article for their, they had an upcoming California Evil issue. The Manson case broke just as they were pasting up their galleys or whatever they do. So they were going to send me out there, but the long bops Gay Talese, who's an eminently respected journalist, so I get nudged from the gig, and he goes out there and does a really very excellent job on writing about the Spahn Ranch for Esquire, but I'm left here with a bunch of notes I'd taken, so I decided that I better just check it out a little more, and I wrote a synopsis of stuff and got a book contract from the late Hal Charlotte at Dutton, and then, you know, began looking into it, which has not stopped to this day, I guess.
Any comment on the latest event in California?
No, other than I knew Squeaky about as well as any of them, because she was the spokeswoman for the family in its relationship with the press and in almost all other, she was the errand runner for Charles, I believe, all during the time. And I was impressed with her ability in subsequent years to develop within her a strong will. And because when I knew her up to 71, she did not appear to be a person that would do anything other than what was told for her to do. However, I must relate that I have examined some of her correspondence that she wrote the summer prior to the assassination attempt, and I've noted that there did not seem to be in any of the correspondence that I've read, and some of it among members of the Manson family, any indication of any impending violence or anything of an untoward or violent nature. So it could well be that she, part of her psyche, decided to do that as a gesture or in some way to perhaps to end her troubles. I mean, here's a woman that's got to serve a person or a cause that's, I know a lot about the inner machinations of the Manson family the last couple of years, and it's, there was another occult society that came in and snatched off a bunch of the members. So the Manson lost control of some of his key people to another occult society. I won't mention the name of a really right-wing, anti-black group. And I understand it's amazing enough that in the anti-black movement that there was some indication that Manson was considered too far to the left on that racist movement, and that this other group was way far to the right of Manson, and they felt he was pigeoning, or felt he was I don't know what the word is, he was a sort of revisionist or some sort of unmilitant isn't the right word, but unforceful enough. So it's he was kind of caught in that. Anyway, he lost some of them, his people apparently, to this group. And then Susan Atkins has recently become a Jesus adept, so that she is lost to him. And so has, I think, Krenwinkel perhaps, and Van Houten also have gone from his fold. So really all that was left is firm Manson adepts, the way I understand it, where Squeaky, otherwise known as Lynn Frohm, and Sandy Good, both of whom were living on P Street in Sacramento, attired in red robes. And a Manson, the way I understand it, had recently decided that it was all money, or that they had to organize the fiscal aspect of it. And these women apparently had organized something called Ecology Incorporated, and were incorporated some sort of, I don't know, you can laugh and say it was some sort of weird population control device, you know, the ultimate solution to the California smog problem or something, but that's kind of maybe facetious. But anyway, I just can't see, unless there was a third party involved, I just cannot see that they were wired up by him to do this, because the lines of communication were very circumscribed. That is, they didn't go direct, any direct letters, and they tried to see him the Tuesday before a shooting, or attempted shooting, and they couldn't get through to him. So,
you think the Ford assassination attempt was either spontaneous or
Well, it's chauvinist to say that she couldn't have developed in the intervening years her own very strong desires and will on the subject. And for people to continually to say she's some sort of pawn and she's just a girl who does whatever a man or anybody else says, probably not so. I mean, she like everybody else, probably, speculation, but I would say, would have been affected by the tides of change as much as anybody else, and she probably felt that she would do something, and she sure did.
The Manson murder and case sort of put an end to an era culturally in America, and I wonder if it's not as a result of that that you return to the late 50s and early 60s and mm-hmm. your book, Tale of Beatnik Glory, mm-hmm. because there's a certain joyous plenitude mm-hmm. and also innocence about it.
Yeah, you say it better than I would. The point is that you said something that I feel deeply, that it's the old-time religion. No, it's the beliefs, the shared beliefs of the generation which I grew up. I was a boy from Missouri. I came to New York like a religious adept, like somebody who would now join Hare Krishna, only I joined Beatnik Krishna. I joined the great Church of Ginsburg or the Church of Poetry and Jazz and Happiness and non-repressive existence. So I feel these values shared by this generation, and it's not a sentimental gibberish from a punk, I believe, to say it, that these values represented a line of values that go right back to the patriots in Boston and the East Coast. That is, you know, don't tread on me, live free, we must love one another or die. That's the Auden line, you know, and just as free society of free people. Mm-hmm. And none of those values, in my judgment, were reflected in the events of many of the events of the late 60s.
Do you see any hope for those values?
Well, except the command generation now is really the beat generation, because all the beats are 50, and the guys and girls that were affected by them are taken over, really. I mean, Jesus, look at what's happening. The pot laws are easing. If you look positively, you know, there may be some hope. I don't know. I mean, I would say that to get a little economic justice. You know, Ginsburg's line of about when am I going to be able to go into a supermarket and get what I want with a smile, or just pay for it with my smile, and that's the principle, and that's the next step. But we'll see.
Your book is called Tales of Beatnik Glory, but there's a certain flow to it, of one narrative to into the other, so that you conceived of it as a whole, really.
Yes. First of all, it's united by common characters in many of the stories, same people described in many of the stories, same time, same place, Lower East Side, Lower West Side, New York City's Bohemia, same time frame, 59, roughly through the Cuban Missile Crisis of the fall of 1962, same cultural events.
Were there certain very specific cultural phenomena you thought had to be included to sort of give an idea of the whole and to give it the flow, the mm-hmm. energy and flow mm-hmm. That is in the book?
Well, I tried to focus in on the rising phenomenon of the underground filmmaker. I focused in on poetry and poetry readings and magazine printing, especially Mimeograph magazine. I focused in on the peace movement, on peace walks, on anti-nuclear war rallies. I focused in on the new arrangements relative to the conjunction of bodies, that is, on the mattress by the canty bottle with a candle in it, the new freedom thereupon, and the new freedom relative to cannabis. And I commented on that many of those strands of culture, I guess. So trying to bring it all into one unit. That is, it's like a big hors d'oeuvre with toothpicks stuck in all different directions, and the toothpicks represent the shafts of description that I placed upon the event in my way.
A moment earlier you were talking about the command generation. Do you think that now that poetry reading is a huge vogue and cinema, magazines, and small press are really sort of large, what are called hip enterprises. Do you think that all of that has gone commercial?
Or been a lot of it, yes. And that's one thing you're always going to see, you know. Like we moved to the Lower East Side in the late 50s and early 60s, and then a few years later it suddenly became the East Village, and the rents went up, and it's just one of the problems. Like when artists move to a place like Bolinas, California, or Woodstock, New York, the real estate people move in, and all of a sudden you can't afford to live in Bolinas unless you got $50,000, or can't, you know. And just, or, you know, I went into a real estate office in the Greenwich Village the other day, and I said, look, I want to move back to New York City, and I want a two-room apartment. And the guy said, can you afford $650? Can I afford $650? I mean, I can't believe it. It's a little store with, you know, the broom plants in the window, you know what I mean, the zebra plant and everything, you know, with the, you know, $650. Anyway, that's the problem, is the commercialization occurs on every level. I don't know. The answer is, you know, is to live at the lowest lifestyle you feel you can. I mean, lowest economically, to my mind, and it exists. And any extra money you have, get rid of it. Give it away or help other people. Like Allen Ginsberg does. He's a perfect example of a person who spreads it around.
What Paul Goodman calls decent poverty.
Right. Decent poverty. That's it. Kenneth Rexroth, yeah, he's talking about, you know, can still get a good wine, you know, and that's it. Cuisine and good conversation, brilliant books. You can all dance. And so what else you need, you know? You don't need a telephone scrambler. You can call Beirut, Lebanon, and, you know, order some half gallon of hash oil for your bathtub or something. You know, you don't need that.
You have been listening to an interview with Ed Sanders and a reading from his book, Tales of Beatnik Glory. Mr. Sanders was interviewed by Charles Ruas and Rick Harris. The program was produced by Bob Bouter and Betsy Scott Chapman. Technical assistance by David Rapkin. Thank you for listening.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org. And is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.